This is the case of HERA Educational Services North America versus Frank Augustine et al. The minutes I have here indicate that Mr. Myers will be arguing on behalf of Defendant Sinato, and Mr. Holtzman will be arguing on behalf of Defendant Vogel. I don't have any minutes for you, Mr. Gordon. I assume by process of deduction that you are Mr. Bernstein's counsel, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. We don't have any time allocated for you. And I understand you're just available to answer questions if the court has any, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. If there are any questions specific to Representative Bernstein, I'm available, but otherwise I've deferred to the co-counsel to answer the issues.
Okay, very good. And Mr. Myers, you have 6 minutes and three for rebuttal, and Mr. Holtzman has 6 minutes, is that correct?
That is correct, although the rebuttal, we're not sure who will address that because it depends upon how the argument goes. One of myself or Mr. Holtzman will do the rebuttal.
Okay, all right, as long as we just have one counsel on rebuttal. All right, with that, Mr. Myers, you may begin.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Carl Myers from Stradley Ronan in Philadelphia. I'm here today representing Christopher Sinato, who is the representative for the 9th Legislative District in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Just to set it up, I will be addressing the question of legislative immunity for 6 minutes. I will pass it over to Mr. Holtzman to address the question of qualified immunity for 6 minutes. We're gonna defer to our briefs in the interest of time on the balance of the questions. If the court has appellate jurisdiction questions, Mr. Holtzman can field those, and of course, Mr. Gordon is available for questions specific as to Representative Bernstein. But starting with the question of legislative immunity, the three legislators each have fully asserted legislative immunity under the speech or debate clauses of the federal and Pennsylvania constitutions. Those clauses provide the legislators with absolute protection for all actions that they undertook within the sphere of legitimate legislative activity. As the court surely is well aware, the Supreme Court has mandated that those clauses must be broadly construed to effectuate their purposes. And so they go well beyond literal speech or debate. So they include things like committee subpoenas, they include legislative reports, they include investigations, they include fact-finding missions. And they also, those protections extend outside the chamber walls. The one thing that must be excluded from consideration is motive and intent. The Supreme Court has said time and again that the reason why a legislator undertakes a specific action is not to be considered in the legislative immunity analysis. It's the intrinsic nature of the act that matters, not the reason why the legislator undertook it. So here the question for the court is, were the legislator's actions taken in the legitimate legislative sphere? And to answer that question, the question is, well, what is the dispute in this case? And this is a dispute over the sale of Commonwealth-owned property. And so the question becomes, what does the legislature have to do with the sale of Commonwealth property? And the answer is everything. The General Assembly enacted a statute over a century ago saying that it had the power to decide the disposition, the sale or not non-sale of Commonwealth property. And in 1981, enacted Act 48. And Act 48 provides a specific process with legislative oversight from the General Assembly and includes a set of criteria that must be followed for every surplus property sale. And at the end of the process, the proceeds by legislation under Act 48 have to be deposited into the Treasury, where they are subject to the plenary appropriating power of the General Assembly.
Your brief does a very good job in laying this out, and I know there's a limited amount of time. It seems to me that on the Senate resolution, this is squarely legislative activity. So I'm more interested in the other matters, the letter to Governor Wolf and some of the things done outside, the meeting with the Department of General Services. And so if you could help us tell us why these are legislative activities and not advocacy or lobbying.
Absolutely, Judge Sirica. And thank you for that question. On the question of the letter, and just to reiterate the point on the resolution, I think it's pretty clear. Powell versus McCormick makes it very clear that legislative resolutions and appearing in front of a committee considering a resolution is squarely within legislative immunity. On the letter and the meeting with DGS, it's important to remember they met with DGS and the DGS secretary. That is the officer, the cabinet officer, who is charged with implementing Act 48. So the fact that they met with DGS is no accident, because this was part of legislative oversight. It's the legislators meeting with, writing letters to and meeting with the implementing power under Act 48 to make sure Act 48 is being administered the way it was supposed to be administered. And also it was a discussion and a letter in the precursor to possible legislation, because at that point, Senate Resolution 154 was still pending. And as a matter of fact—
You know, I hate to interrupt, but I have to tell you, I understand that before you worry about immunity, you worry about whether or not there's been a pleading which set forth a statutory or constitutional violation. Because if it isn't, then you don't, there's no question of immunity. And if you look at, if you go through this carefully, this is what we saw, what I saw. That they wrote a letter to the governor. They spoke at a community meeting. They called for an investigation. They made statements to local news authorities disapproving the sale. And they introduced a resolution. Is there anything actionable in any of that? Because if there isn't, then you don't have to worry about immunity.
Well, Your Honor, we agree. We actually, all three legislators asserted that HIRA had failed to state a claim, an actionable claim on any of its counts. Unfortunately, we're here today because Judge Schwab summarily rejected the legislative immunity defenses, and that necessitated us taking a collateral order appeal, because an absolute immunity defense is immediately appealable under settled precedent. So we agree, and were things otherwise, and did things play out differently in the district court, we wouldn't even be having this discussion. And we do agree that the HIRA has failed to state a claim. But the simple reality is that we're here on an immunity defense because it was denied in the district court. And so we had to take an immediate appeal to protect our clients.
Yeah, well, the district court can do what it wants, but this is a court of appeals. And I think we have to first, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, look at what the allegations are that they did wrong. And if they didn't do anything that's actionable, then you don't have to worry about immunity. Maybe I don't understand it, but that's what I thought the law was.
Well, that is true. That is true, Judge Greenberg. And that actually sort of introduces the qualified immunity analysis that Mr. Holtzman's about to speak to. But to answer your question, we do have to accept the allegations as they are on the face of the pleading. And we submit that even accepting all of his allegations as true, because we have to, it's at the motion to dismiss,
yes,
that there is an absolute immunity, either legislative immunity or qualified immunity or a combination of the two, even assuming those allegations are true, that absolutely protects the legislators from liability. I see I'm keeping time here. I see I've gone over my 6 minutes. So I'm unless the court has questions, additional questions on the legislative immunity, I was going to pass the matter over to Mr. Holtzman.
I don't.
Is there anything else you want to tell us about legislative immunity that we haven't touched on?
Well, not without keeping the court here for the rest of the afternoon. I have lots of things I can share about legislative immunity. I would simply say that all of the categories of activities, there really are three buckets. There is the resolution, communications with executive branch officials, and communications with constituents. And all of these activities are quintessentially legislative in nature. Legislators have to represent their constituents. They have to give voice to their constituents. And the only way they can do that is if they can actually listen to their constituents, speak with their constituents, and then relay constituent concerns to others, including other people in other branches of government. So in my mind anyway, it's an easy call that everything that happened here is subject to legislative immunity. I'll turn over to Mr. Holtzman now.
And if we thought that some of the matters should be better handled with qualified immunity, you would still win.
Yes, absolutely. It's really two sides, Judge Sirica. It's two sides of the same coin, because if the court looks at this as a legislative in nature, so it's the legislature carrying out its power to decide whether real estate should be sold or not as a policy matter and as a legislative matter, then it falls within legislative immunity. But if on the other hand, the court views some of the allegations as legislators advocating for executive branch officials, then it's qualified immunity, and that's the X-Men case. But I don't want to steal Mr. Holtzman's thunder on that.
I understand.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Myers. Mr. Holtzman?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. My name is Anthony Holtzman, and I represent Senator Vogel in these consolidated appeals. And really, piggyback on what Mr. Myers just mentioned a moment ago, to the extent that high-risk allegations here against the legislators are not perceived to be allegations regarding activities covered by legislative immunity, they are assuredly allegations about certain types of speech and advocacy that the legislators performed in their official capacities. And because the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution protects the very forms of speech and advocacy at issue here, and because HIRA does not have a constitutional or statutory right to require the legislators not to engage in these constitutionally protected activities, the legislators are entitled to qualified immunity for having engaged in them. As the court knows, the doctrine of qualified immunity shields government officials from being sued in connection with their performance of discretionary functions, as long as their performance of those functions does not violate clearly established constitutional or statutory rights that a reasonable person would have known about. It's very important to note that under this framework, a plaintiff does not have a constitutional or a statutory right to require state legislators to refrain from engaging in forms of speech and advocacy that are protected by the First Amendment. And in fact, along these lines, this court has already recognized that in light of the First Amendment, a government official cannot be subjected to the types of claims that HIRA is asserting here for speaking with a government official or agency and encouraging that official or agency to make some decision on some basis, regardless of whether the advocated basis is alleged to be inflammatory or improper in some way. And so in particular, I'm talking about and want to focus for a moment on this court's decision in McLaughlin versus Watson, which is found at 271 Federal Third Reporter, page 566. This is a decision the court handed down in 2001. And there the plaintiffs allege that the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, a man named Mr. Stiles, had spoken with Pennsylvania's Attorney General, Mr. Fisher, who was the plaintiff's employer, and influenced Mr. Fisher to take a variety of what they claimed were adverse employment actions against them. And the plaintiffs claimed that through that particular course of conduct, Mr. Stiles had violated their First Amendment rights. But this court concluded that it was, in fact, the First Amendment itself that protected Mr. Stiles' conversations with Mr. Fisher, and that as a result, Mr. Stiles was entitled to qualified immunity for having engaged in those conversations. And the court stated as follows, quote, "We note in this regard that the alleged improper conduct itself took the form of speech. Conversations with Fisher, where Stiles allegedly influenced Fisher to take adverse action against the plaintiffs," close quote. That's at page 574 of this court's opinion in McLaughlin. Now, notably, in reaching that conclusion and determining that Mr. Stiles was entitled to qualified immunity, this court cited with approval the Second Circuit's decision in the case called X-Men Security Incorporated versus Pataki, found at 196 Federal Third Reporter, page 56. That's a decision the Second Circuit down in 1999. And as your honors probably are aware, the legislators explain in some detail in their briefs that the X-Men decision is closely analogous to this case from a qualified immunity perspective. And just to kind of summarize the point, the Second Circuit emphasized in X-Men that the First Amendment protects a legislator's right to state publicly his or her criticism of the granting of a public contract to a given entity and urge the decision makers that the award of the contract shouldn't happen, would contravene public policy, or otherwise would be unadvisable. And notably, the two legislators in X-Men lacked the authority to decide who would receive the public contracts that were at issue there. And the First Amendment, as a result, protected about why the decision makers should not award those contracts to a company called X-Men, including their allegedly false and inflammatory statements about that company's religious orientation and practices. In light of those factors, the Second Circuit held that the legislators were entitled to qualified immunity. So similarly, in this case, what we have is that HIRA is alleging, quite correctly, Your Honors, that it was the Pennsylvania Department of General Services, DGS, and not who had the authority to decide who would receive the public contract to purchase the YDC property, which is the property at issue in this case. Therefore, just like the legislator statements in X-Men, the First Amendment protects the legislator's stated concerns here about DGS's choice to award the contract to HIRA, even if those concerns were allegedly inflammatory or false. Simply put, the First Amendment protects the legislator's statements, and HIRA does not have a right, let alone a clearly established one, to use 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 statute to prevent the legislators from making them. So I think my time is up at this point, Your Honors. We'll save the rest of our time for rebuttal unless you have any questions for me at this point.
One quick question. With respect to the Shenango Township action that was taken there, the qualified immunity would also apply. That's your position in this matter?
And Jessica, are you referring to the enactment of the local ordinance?
Yes.
I don't believe there are any allegations in the complaint that connect the legislators in this matter with the enactment of that ordinance. The extent that there's some inference in the complaint that the legislators advocated for the enactment of the ordinance, then yes, I think the same analytical framework would apply because, again, the decision maker, if you will, the governmental entity that took a state action in your scenario there was Shenango Township and not the legislators. They were merely advocates. But again, I don't recall that there was any allegation to that effect in the complaint.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Holtzman. Before we go to Ms. Jump, Mr. Gordon, a quick question for you, since Mr. Holtzman was just talking about qualified immunity. I didn't see anywhere that Defendant Bernstein raised qualified immunity in the district court. Am I right or wrong about that?
Your Honor, I believe it was raised in our brief on the motion to dismiss, but
Why don't you tell me where? Tell us where you raised it.
I apologize, Your Honor. I do not have the exact pin site.
All right, we'll come back to you after Ms. Jump because you'll have at least 15 minutes to look that up. I need you to tell us where that was raised in the district court, because if it wasn't, it was forfeited. So go ahead and look at that, and we'll turn to Ms. Jump.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The first question we need to ask here and answer here, as with any proceeding, is whether this court has jurisdiction. And my colleagues on the other side of the bench went past that a bit. The district court here determined that there were fact issues and dismissed these motions to dismiss without prejudice in June of 2018, finding that fact issues existed regarding whether the actions of the defendants and now appellants warranted immunity defenses. In finding so, the district court stated that whether any of these individuals is entitled to immunity rests upon whether the individuals engaged in legitimate activities while in the course and scope of their position and authority. And the district court then held that detailed and well-pled allegations in the complaint allege that none of these individuals did so. Thus, the discussion was mired in facts. The district court did not at any point eliminate an avenue for the defendants, now appellants, to proceed or to reassert this again or even bring it up on appeal down the road. Instead, the district court simply called the motions premature and
Let me ask you this question, though. Unless the complaint alleges facts that could establish liability, then even if there's a dispute of facts, if there's a claim of immunity to it, then isn't that a legal question, which doesn't depend on the, you have to take the facts as alleged. So maybe they can't be proven, but the mere fact that you make an allegation and then there's a claim of immunity, don't you have a right to have the Court of Appeals take jurisdiction? It's denied, of course.
Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, and feel free to correct me if I don't, that there's not an absolute right to the immunity, and particularly in these situations, as many courts have stated, that immunity is not appropriate where the act or decision, first of all, it affects only a small number or a single individual.
No, I'm not suggesting that there's immunity or not. I'm just suggesting that if you raise the immunity defense, in effect, what you're doing is, you're, for purposes of your motion, you're conceding that the allegations have to be taken as alleged.
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. I apologize, Your Honor. I didn't understand the question correctly the first time. I do agree that there has not been a dispute in the proceedings here as we've progressed, that in the motion to dismiss, the defendants and now appellants alleged a lot of different grounds. The judge ruled on the basis that the immunity issue was premature and could be reasserted later, and that's what we've brought forward, and that's what we're appealing on. And that is the only issue that's come forward.
Why is it premature if it's addressing the complaint as alleged and you're taking the facts as alleged? And why is it premature?
Because there are factual disputes, which would be premature at the motion to dismiss stage, where the facts need to be taken.
I understand that there are factual disputes, but if the defendant is moving to dismiss on the grounds that he has immunity, why do you have to resolve the factual disputes if he takes the complaint as it's alleged?
Okay. Your Honor, again, I apologize, and please do feel free to point out if I am off track. But as I understand your question, the question of whether the immunity would apply, even if we're taking the facts as alleged, comes down to whether those acts were performed for the legitimate legislative purposes within the scope of the position. And legislative acts involve policymaking of a general scope, not specific. Again, it wouldn't kick in where it's as to where the action affects only a small number of individuals. And
well, what you're saying is that they don't have the immunity. All I'm saying, I'm only concerned right now with the question of jurisdiction. And wouldn't there be jurisdiction at least to see if they have immunity on the facts as alleged?
Your Honor, at this stage in an appeal from a motion to dismiss, the only way that this court would have jurisdiction on appeal from that interlocutory order would be if there was an absolute immunity where the collateral order rule would kick in, and we don't believe that the collateral order rule does apply here. Therefore, we don't believe that there is jurisdiction. I believe that the appellants misplaced their reliance on the collateral order doctrine. It is one that kicks in only in rare circumstances, and it only kicks in where
it's not rare in cases involving immunity. The collateral order doctrine is quite frequent in cases involving claims of either qualified immunity or legislative immunity, because it's immunity from suit. It's not just immunity from judgment. It's immunity from suit. So let me follow up on Judge Greenberg's question about jurisdiction. What are the disputed issues of fact that justified the district court's denial of immunity? Because that's sort of the exception of the collateral order doctrine. When we get a case involving immunity and there are important or material issues of fact in dispute, then those need to be determined by the district court before it comes up to the Court of Appeals. consistent with Judge Greenberg's question, don't we just look at the facts of this complaint and assume that they're all true? And then don't we have jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine? Or are there some disputed issues of fact that you can cite for us to show us that we don't have jurisdiction over this appeal?
Yes, I believe that I can do that. Your Honor, this court in Zaccardi versus City of Philadelphia, I think, is the most applicable to this, to your instant question, that the collateral order doctrine will not attach where issues on appeal, where the main issue on appeal is whether there is a genuine issue of material fact, and there is a genuine issue of material fact on the circumstances, which again, the district court's order in this matter did not delineate each one, did not go through and itemize, but said that the specific allegations were mired in the facts, and pointed out, for example.
And I'm asking you to tell us what those facts are. Just
yes, Your Honor.
Give me some facts that are in dispute here that deprive us of jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine.
The facts that are in dispute is whether the actions that were taken were for legitimate legislative purposes or not. And in order to determine that, we need to look at the specific facts and get determination on, for example, whether, as argued today by my counsel on the other side, whether the legislators, Defendant Vogel, particularly mentioned that being involved in the sale at issue is something that he believes would fall in the scope of legislative, but it's pled in document 82 in the record at pages 28 to 30, or stated, I'm sorry, in document 82 at 28 to 30, that Defendant Vogel stated that he didn't have any involvement in that. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say that their duties make this a legislative issue and make it centrally formed and involved with the legislative acts, and that they're not responsible for it because it wasn't their job. They can't have it both ways. In addition, speeches that are made outside of Congress, outside of the legislative context, are not in and of themselves automatically determined to be something that is warranting of immunity. The immunity does not cover political activities, which can include a wide range, such as newsletters, news releases, speeches outside of Congress. That's U.S. v. Brewster, the Supreme Court opinion, and the statements that were made, particularly at these public meetings that happened, which were not called by any government official. These are public meetings that occurred at a private location, and they were the defendants showed up and spoke at them, but these were not specifically public meetings that were called by the legislators in their legislative capacity, but statements that were made there that said things such as, we need to look into any national security type issues which may arise because of the nature of the entity of HIRA as being a Muslim-based institution that was planning to have the facility for youth, for Muslim youth specifically. The allegations that there was something illegal happening regarding HIRA, again, that there might be any sort of national security issue relating to HIRA with no foundation given for that, those absolutely go outside the scope of the necessary legislative activity. And again, under U.S. v. Brewster, the Supreme Court has said that that's not within the scope of what triggers immunity. There is...
Again, all right, let's assume that we agree with you on that. What about qualified immunity? X-Men from the Second Circuit hurts you. It goes the other way. Mm-hmm. But I assume your response to X-Men is, well, that's the Second Circuit. We're in the Third. We don't have to follow it. Is that right?
That's part of the response to X-Men, yes. But it is not controlling on this.
Okay. Point. All right. So what law is controlling on this court that has a fact pattern like X-Men or a fact pattern like this case that goes your way?
I believe that what is relevant here, again, if we were to look at the Zaccardi case versus City of Philadelphia, again, there it said that the holding of this court is that the if there is a genuine issue of material fact, then the collateral order rule does not apply. And
I know. Well, now we're beyond jurisdiction. Now we've already covered jurisdiction.
Okay.
So we're talking about qualified immunity, Mike. I think we've agreed that the X-Men case is not favorable to you. And as you pointed out, it's not controlling on this circuit. You're quite right about that. So my question for you is, tell us the name of a case or cases that are controlling on this court that have a fact pattern similar to your fact pattern, such that the defendants in this case would be put on notice that their behavior was illegal.
Your Honor, I believe, for instance, something in this court is that the Montgomery County case, which is cited in our briefs, which is Third Circuit from 2000. In that case, on which defendants rely, one of the distinguishing factors is that the court simply found that there were no viable claims on the merits. It was not deciding, that's not what we have here. Here, the district court did not reach that issue and decided that there were fact issues and that's what needed to be looked at. So I think the Montgomery County case shows us within the Third Circuit, one of the things that needs to be considered in looking at the immunity issue. I would also say that in the Oliver case, which is cited by my colleagues across the aisle as well, the court found that there was an already existing legal determination. And here, the district court was very clear and made in two separate rulings, both in the original one on June 13th and in a subsequent ruling on June 18th, after there had been additional briefing on an unrelated issue regarding potential joiner of a different necessary party that's not at issue on this appeal, the district court made very clear that this was not an existing final legal determination. There was no final legal determination made by the district court as to whether any type of immunity applied. Simply, the district court held that these were mired in facts, and the district court found that additional factual discovery and factual response would be needed in order to determine whether that legal defense applied. So it is different than how this court held in Oliver, because in Oliver there was an existing legal determination. That's not what we have here. We also do not have an issue that is completely separate. If we look under the Coopers and Librand, standards or factors, that there is no issue here which is completely separate from the merits. And in fact, again, the district court made it clear that these fact issues turn on, that the allegations within the complaint turn on factual determinations that do directly relate to the merits. And finally, this is not unreviewable. Again, the dismissal ordered by the district court, the orders that are on appeal here, were without prejudice in order to be able to reassert them at a later date, and also could be reviewable at a later date. So I don't believe that we can make any of that the appellants here can satisfy any of those requirements. As you know, in Harlow v. Fitz, the United States Supreme Court, which obviously is binding, of course, on this court, qualified immunity only applies if the conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights, where a reasonable person would have known of them. And here we have stated the statutory rights under both the federal statute of RLUIPA, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, as well as the state equivalent, the RFPA, and then also the First Amendment, and then there are 1983 claims here as well. All of which do establish very clear rights that, based solely on the religion of the religion-focused side of the entity here of HIRA and its religious nature, is protected under the Establishment Clause and what's already codified in RLUIPA, as well as the state's Religious Freedom Protection Act and the First Amendment. We're not solely on First Amendment here, incidentally, which was not addressed by my colleagues on the other side. But even with the First Amendment, there are clearly stated rights, there are clearly stated issues here. There are a clearly stated recovery to action, and I don't believe that the qualified immunity would apply even in that circumstance, because there is a clearly stated right. At most, what should happen is additional discovery, or any discovery, discovery should be allowed to begin to determine whether the actions that were taken by these defendants, whether they were in fact things that can be considered to be legitimate activities taken in the course and scope of their positions and authority. We also heard earlier today from counsel on the other side, again, both that because this involved the sale of property and that's a state task that the legislators had a right and it counts as a legitimate activity for them to become involved, but also that they were not involved in the sale and that they can't be held responsible because they didn't have anything to do with the sale. It was DGS. They can't have it both ways. That requires more factual investigation and for discovery to in fact take place and move forward.
Thank you, Ms. Jump. Do you have any other questions, Judge Greenberg?
No.
Judge Sirica?
Nor do I.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jump. Mr. Gordon, we're going to return to the question I asked before Ms. Jump made her argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I looked and apparently I don't think that our briefing below does raise qualified immunity specifically, but I do think that we raise the heart of the qualified immunity defense is that there is not a clearly established right. And so we do raise extensively in our motion to dismiss that all of the rights raised by HIRA in its complaint are not clearly established. So I would also note that I think the defense of qualified immunity can be raised at any time during the proceeding before a trial. So to the extent Representative Bernstein deemed to not have adequately raised it in the motion to dismiss, he could raise it again on a motion for judgment on the pleadings or for a motion for summary judgment in this court, or the district court would have to address it then. So to the extent we believe we did raise the same issues that are there in the qualified immunity, but if we didn't specifically say qualified immunity and that is deemed a waiver, we believe this court could still address that because that issue would then go back to the district court and the district court would have to decide the issue on a motion for judgment on the pleadings or summary judgment. But I apologize, I don't think we, Representative Bernstein's motion specifically said it, but we did raise all the same arguments about why there's not a clearly established right before our briefing here were raised in the motion to dismiss brief.
All right. Well, we have a pretty strong forfeiture doctrine in the circuit, and if you want qualified immunity, you have to ask for it. Your review is consistent with my study of it, that you raised legislative immunity and the Norr Pennington doctrine, but not qualified immunity. So you may, that's not an issue for us then. Whether it's an issue for the district court or not, we'll leave to the district court. But the court thanks you and Mr. Holtzman and Mr. Myers, and we thank Ms. Jump for the arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement.